Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, prayer means listening to God. At his Wednesday General Audience, Pope Benedict says that today, amid the din of so many useless words, many people have lost the habit of listening to God. Memories of Mother Teresa. On the 15th anniversary of her death, we remember Blessed Mother Teresa of Calcutta, one of the world's best-known and revered religious figures, with the help of the postulator for her sainthood cause. And are Christians in Britain being sacked because of their beliefs? We hear more about the closely watched case involving four British Christians who claim they lost their jobs as a result of discrimination and are appealing to the European Court of Human Rights. Pope Benedict says that today, amid the din of so many useless words, many people have lost the habit of listening to God through prayer. His remarks came during his continuing catechesis on prayer at his Wednesday General Audience. Chris Altieri reports.
In his catechetical remarks, the Pope focused on the theme of prayer as found at the start of the book of Revelation, also known as the Apocalypse. In some ways, said Pope Benedict, it is a difficult book, but it contains many riches. The Holy Father went on to say that right from its opening verses, the book of Revelation begins to tell us that prayer means, above all, listening to the God who speaks to us.
Today, amidst the din of so many useless words, many people have lost the habit of listening, even to God's word. The opening lines of the Apocalypse teach us that prayer is not just more words, asking God to grant our various needs, but rather it must begin as praise to God for his love and for his gift of Jesus Christ, who has brought us strength, hope, and salvation.
The Pope said that we too are to welcome Jesus into our lives, to proclaim our yes to Christ, and to nourish and deepen our Christian living.
Constant prayer will reveal to us the meaning of God's presence in our lives and in history. Prayer with others, liturgical prayer in particular, will deepen our awareness of the crucified and risen Jesus in our midst. Thus, the more we know, love, and follow Christ, the more we will want to meet him in prayer for his peace, hope, and strength of our lives.
After the catechesis, Pope Benedict greeted pilgrims in many languages, including English.
I am pleased to welcome all English-speaking pilgrims and visitors present today, including those from England, Indonesia, Japan, the Philippines, and the United States. I am especially pleased to welcome the group of missionaries as the servants of the Holy Spirit, as well as young men and women of the Focolari movement who have been participating. Thank you. Participating in the Zen Fest in Budapest. The young people, you have taken to heart Christ's call to promote unity in the human family by courageously building bridges. I therefore encourage you, be strong in your Catholic faith and let the simple joy, the pure love, and the profound peace that come from the encounter with Jesus Christ make you radiant witnesses of the good news before the young people of your own lands. God bless all of you abundantly. Thank you.
Pope Benedict held his general audiences at Castel Gandolfo during the month of August. The return to Rome for the Wednesday appointment comes just over a week before the Pope's scheduled departure for Lebanon from September 14th to September 16th. I'm Chris Altieri.
I feel if the world today turns its back to the poor, I think they are turning their back to Christ.
The voice of Blessed Mother Teresa of Calcutta, who dedicated her life to the poor the sick and the dying.
The work is only a means to put our love for Christ into action. And so I had only to change the way of work, the means I had to change to work for the poorest of the poor. So my vocation was a continuation of belonging to Christ and being only His.
Founder of the Missionaries of Charity Order, Mother Teresa was one of the world's best known and loved religious figures. Throughout her long life, she was revered for her holiness and her compassion towards the poorest of the poor, and was often known as the Saint of the Gutters. She received numerous awards for her work, including the Nobel Peace Prize in 1979. Mother Teresa died exactly 15 years ago, at the age of 87. She was beatified in 2003. Mother Teresa was unstinting in her charity work on behalf of the poor in nations like India, but she also often voiced her concern about what she called the spiritual poverty of the richer Western world.
There is two kinds of poverty. We have the poverty of material, like for example, in some places like in India and Ethiopia and Yemen, other places, where the people are hungry for a loaf of bread, a real hunger. But there is much deeper, much greater hunger, and that is the hunger for love, and that terrible loneliness and being unwanted, unloved, being abandoned by everybody.
In a talk she once gave, Mother Teresa gave this eloquent and moving description of her feelings after visiting an old people's home in England, where nobody lacked for material comforts, but what they did lack was something far more precious and elusive.
I visited a home, one of the best homes in England. Our sisters are there working. I have never seen so much wonderful things in a home like I saw in that home. And yet, there was not a single smile on the faces of those people. All these old people, they were all looking towards the door. And I asked the sister in charge, and I said, sister, why are they like that? Why are they not smiling? I'm so used to see smiles on people's faces because I think smile generates smiles, just as love generates love. And then she said, this is every day like that. They're always waiting for somebody to come and visit them. The loneliness is eating them up. And for days after days, they keep on looking. Nobody turns up. That unwantedness is great poverty.
10 years after her death, a book containing a collection of Mother Teresa's letters was published that revealed for the first time the astonishing truth of how she spent many decades struggling with doubts about her faith and the existence of Jesus. Entitled Mother Teresa, Come Be My Light, the book was edited and compiled by Father Brian Koladechuk, a Missionaries of Charity father who worked closely with her for 20 years. He's also the postulator for her sainthood cause. Father Brian is convinced that these surprising revelations about Mother Teresa's spiritual darkness make her even more saintly and heroic. He sat down with me and began by describing what impact Mother Teresa had had on his own life.
St. John says, how can you say that you love God whom you don't see if you do not love your neighbor whom you see?
I first met Mother Teresa because my sister is also an MC sister. So the direct impact was I came to Rome and I had no idea of joining. And so that the encounter was Mother Teresa inviting me to join. At that time, there was a group of contemplative brothers. And then after, in 1983, we began the Fathers. So I'd like to say Mother kind of fished both my sister and I out, so she got both of us to join. So the direct influence was actually Mother Teresa inviting me to join. But then through the years, just being close to her, watching her, learning, even that experience was already something very special and important. But I think even for like a further or more complete understanding and knowledge of Mother Teresa was being the postulator, putting all together. I remember when we finished the positio, you know, the study that we have to present to the Congregation for the Causes of Saints, I had my little piece of the pie. I had my experience, and other people had, you know, the sisters and the early sisters and different people had their kind of experience. But then when you put it all together and look at her life, say, ah, now this is Mother Teresa, which is kind of greater in depth.
Did she impress you straight away with her saintly qualities? I mean, for you, there was no question that this woman was a saint?
There was no question, because the first time I'd actually seen her was in Toronto, because I was studying in Toronto, and she came to speak, and I remember going to see her because she was already known. My sister already joined that year. So there was that first impression, and certainly someone who was very special, and then meeting her directly. But at the same time, you know, sometimes people ask me, well, how was Mother? And I say, well, if you didn't know what she looked like and you went to the convent and you were kind of wondering who's Mother Teresa, at first you may not pick her out, because in that sense she was very ordinary, feet on the ground. But then you would notice, say, the small things of, say, for example, you know, how she would make a sign of the cross, or how she would, say, take the holy water and entering the chapel, how she would make a genuflection, you know, with real attention and awareness or consciousness of what she was doing, not just routine. And so those little small things, she would be putting her love into those small things.
You've written two books about Mother Teresa since her death. And the first of those books, entitled Mother Teresa, Come Be My Light, this revealed for the first time to the outside world how she struggled for decades with doubts about her faith and the existence of God. I mean, these revelations came as a deep shock to many people who never thought for a moment she was a person with such inner spiritual torment. Did it really make people look at her in a very different way after this book was published?
Oh, for sure. I know people made comments, you know, but I think even, say, some people within the church even would have thought, well, she was wonderful. She was known for her generous work with the poor. But knowing that experience and then seeing that experience, interior experience, in the context of her whole life and what she was doing, then they said, oh, wow, now there's really some depth to this woman. Because to actually go through that experience and doing all that she did and doing it joyfully, you know, putting everything together and seeing that positio, that study, this is an heroic life or a heroic Christian life. But then the single most heroic aspect, I think, of Mother's life is that, what she called, that darkness.
You know, did she talk about it a lot?
No, she kept it completely hidden from even her closest sisters. There were a few priests who knew, because at the beginning, during the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, a little bit, then she was kind of getting help from a few very well-chosen Jesuits. But once she got a hang of what really the experience was, and then she was...
She took it in her stride.
She took it in her stride, and she knew it was like, you know, and just in a few words, on one hand, she was so closely united to Jesus in his suffering and that interior suffering. Because sometimes in her instructions she would say, you know, I think Jesus suffered more in the garden than on the cross, thinking of that interior suffering. So she would say, I'm the spouse of Jesus crucified. So she was experiencing that union, paradoxically, being united with Jesus by experiencing non-union. And then the other thing she would always say, especially as she went out in the West, the greatest poverty in the world today is to be unloved, unwanted, uncared for. And that was her experience. So she was not just identified with in solidarity with the physical poor by living physically poor, but also that great spiritual poverty, especially in the West, that she was also living in identity with and even in our Catholic understanding for the sake of.
So when you yourself got to hear about this spiritual darkness that she struggled with, was it for you a surprise?
It was a surprise, because these letters came up because, thankfully, the Jesuits in Calcutta had saved them. So the sister who was involved in collecting the documents, she was in Calcutta, and then she was saying, okay, now here are these letters. So the first thing I did was I took them, because I knew they were very special and sacred. So I went to the chapel to read them. I didn't want to just read them as if they were some letters. They were so sacred in the sense of revealing that interior that she never wanted to speak of.
So it was.
It made an impact. When we were working in Calcutta, that first part of the cause, I would give a talk to the sisters and I'd be reading from city's letters, and the sisters were there, you know, some of them were crying because they're really, you know, the mother they knew, they loved, and then she's going to that, and it's really it makes an impact. The way Mother expressed herself, you just feeling the anguish and what she was suffering.
You also also, later, you wrote a second book in which you compiled many of Mother Teresa's speeches, letters and teachings over the course of her ministry. What was the core message you were trying to get across in this second book?
Well, you know, it was organized according to kind of just basic themes for our Christian life or spiritual life. You know, who is Jesus? Who is God? Obstacles. And then in the positive way, you know, her teaching on how to live some of the, you know, basic Christian attitudes and actions. So it was kind of a sense of really mother teacher, as a teacher, as she was a born teacher, as an excellent teacher.
And she had a universal message, right?
And the universal message, very plain, because she spoke in all kinds of different places. And she, in some things, she would even repeat herself. So it wasn't like every speech was new. But just her saying it and her person and the radiance that she did give of holiness made the impact. A very simple message. And I think the profundity of her message was hidden by her simplicity.
And what was this profundity of her
message? Well, I mean,
if you can sum it up.
Yeah. Her love of the Lord, her deep faith, because she had to have great faith to go through all of that darkness. And really to see Jesus in every person, to love him, to find the ways, ordinary things, small things. So she kept saying, you don't have to do extraordinary things. You don't have to go to Calcutta. Calcutta's everywhere, even in your own family. The small things, you know, because the value is not the actual action, but it's the love with which it is given. She's admirable, but she's also imitable in that sense.
And talking of admiration, of course, she elicited admiration, not just from those around her working most closely with her, but people all around the world, whatever their faith, including many mm-hmm. world mm-hmm. leaders, didn't she?
We were thinking, or I even asked some people, you know, it seems like not since St. Francis did someone have an influence way beyond the church like Mother Teresa. And it was quite phenomenal that God raised someone like her up in our time, in our century, and someone with the message that is also for our time.
Coming back to her character, she was often smiling. She was cheerful in manner. Did she also have a sense of humor? And if
oh,
so,
no,
could you give
did.
Us some examples?
Oh, yes,
give us some
she
examples?
Did have a great sense of humor. She would tell a few jokes.
Can you give us
well,
some examples?
Well, I think the joke about the horse are going toward the cliff, and then they had gotten the kind of the words to say go, stop, or go ahead. It was like, thank God was the one to move ahead. So they're going, and then the fellow on the horse said, okay, stop. And so the password or the keyword, and the horse stops, and then he says, ah, thanks be to God. And then the horse goes over because that was the word to go forward. So those kind of jokes she would like. And then she really had also a sense of humor in just seeing the funny things that happen. Say, like, among the sisters, something will happen, or they say English. A lot of the sisters don't have English as a first language, so they make mistakes with the language, or funny things. You know, working with the people, there would be humorous things. And so, if you ever went, say, to like Mother House in Calcutta, they have the recreation in the evening, say between 8:30 and 9 o'clock, and 300 women, young women, giggling, laughing, and shouting. I mean, it really makes an impression.
She
was right in there, and yeah.
Above all, of course, it was her holiness and her compassion towards the poor, the poorest of the poor. Do you have any particular anecdotes of something she said or did in that regard that was especially memorable or inspirational for you?
Okay, well, I remember just for an example, I think it was actually in Rome here in the airport. We were there, the sisters ourselves were waiting, were with her. The airport personnel would come in and greet her. She'd give her the miraculous medal. And then, okay, it was time to board. Everyone got up and we're all standing around. And then she saw a woman kind of behind the crowd, kind of standing back a little bit, looking sad. So that's how observant she was. She picked that up. And she went to that woman to greet her and just to make her feel important or say a little word or a message. So that even in the midst of the crowd, she would have that attention to those small things. Or another example, also in Rome, there was a special mass. It was all the reporters, even during as she received communion, they were just all around her. It was quite not very edifying. And then at the end, so the mass is over, the procession out of the church, and then she was the only one who really stopped and turned around and made a genuflection to the Blessed Sacrament, which is on the side, not in the sanctuary of the church, but on the side altar. But I remember being so impressed that among all those things and people around, she knew exactly where the tabernacle was, where Jesus was. So that is a couple little examples of that attentiveness and observing and looking. And then also that personal love for Jesus. She made that little act of faith before leaving.
And if you had to sum up in a sentence or two her greatest legacy, her greatest gifts, what would they be for you?
Well, I think especially in our age, you know, she would say, a lot of people are saying there is no God. And then she was saying, but our work shows that God is. Okay, so there's a sense of the testimony that our world, even though all what it is, and technology and science and all those things, yet the work shows that God is. And then the second thing is her life is not imitable. We can't imitate it in a sense. Everyone's not called to go to Calcutta, but we can do those small things. You would say, for example, a smile, just a smile to someone else. Maybe give flowers, or maybe go and read the newspaper. Maybe someone needs help shopping or helping someone across the street. All those little things, if you're attentive, like, you know, she would notice these chances. She would say, well, grab the chance. These small things that are every day right around us, if we, you know, she'd say, if we have eyes to see.
I was speaking to Father Brian Kolodejczuk, author of two books about Mother Teresa and the postulator for her sainthood cause.
Unwanted, unloved, a trivial society, are we there to be that love, that kindness, that thoughtfulness to them?
Four British Christians claim that British employers trample on religious freedoms by barring staff from wearing crosses at work, requiring them to provide sex advice to gays, or to preside at same-sex civil partnership ceremonies. These were the claims made by four British Christians in testimony this week at the European Court of Human Rights. The plaintiffs told the European Court that British law discriminated against them and failed to protect their religious freedom at the workplace. All four had earlier lost separate employment tribunals relating to their beliefs. My colleague Lydia O'Kane spoke to Peter Norris, communications officer at the Christian human rights group Christian Concern.
We're looking at these four British Christians who claim they lost their jobs as a result of discrimination against their beliefs, and they're taking their case to the European Court of Human Rights. First of all, just to get your reaction to the fact that they are taking their case here.
Yeah, well, it's kind of the last resort. They lost their cases in the UK and lost on appeal as well. So this is as far as they can go, really, to the European Court of Human Rights. And the case is... We are handling two of the cases, but there are actually four cases that have been heard, and they kind of pair up. Two of the cases relate to manifesting faith, Christian faith, specifically wearing a cross at work, and two of the cases relate to freedom of conscience, so the freedom of Christians to live out biblical teaching, live out Christian faith. In these cases, particularly concerning sexual ethics and providing certain services to homosexual couples.
Now, is this case, do you think, going to be watched closely? Is there going to be a precedent? People will be looking closely at these four cases?
Definitely, yes. It's caused quite a stir. So it's on the front page of one of the British newspapers today, the Daily Express. And there's been a lot of media coverage of these cases. Christians obviously concerned that their freedoms are protected, but then quite an aggressive secularist lobby also not wanting any concessions to be made. So they're making the argument that if the cases are successful, a hierarchy of rights will be created with religion at the top. But that's not the case. When we're talking about freedom of conscience and freedom of thought, that affects everybody. And it's really about whether we can handle difference. If somebody dissents from the majority opinion, will their opinion be respected? Will they be able to live consistently with their beliefs?
Is this happening more and more? Let's take one of the examples here, the fact that somebody has a religious symbol, they're wearing a cross or a crucifix around their neck. Is it happening more and more that people are finding that they can't do that anymore, that they're being told not to?
I think so, yes. I mean, 20 years ago, even 10 years ago, these cases were not coming up, and all of a sudden they are. And there have been certain changes in legislation that have created these situations where Christians are being told to remove their crosses. And the one of the cases that we are handling is the case of a nurse, Shirley Chaplin, who was wearing her cross round her neck for 30 years in her job, in her nursing job, and then told to remove it. And health and safety reasons were brought in, but only further down the line in the case. And she was willing to make concessions and put the cross on a magnetic clasp so that if it was pulled, it would come off so that she could meet the health and safety requirements, but that wasn't accepted. And the policy has not been applied fairly or uniformly across the board, so other items, other religious symbols have been permitted, for example, headscarves attached with large brooches, turbans, so it's not been fairly applied.
Actually, that was just a question I was going to come to. I was going to ask you, are other religious groups being affected by as well?
It seems not as much. We don't hear of people from other religions with these kind of problems. It seems to be specifically Christianity that people are trying to push out and marginalise. Obviously, it could affect other religions further down the line if these cases are not successful, but there seems to be an asymmetry in the way that these rules are applied to people of different faiths, with Christians coming out at the bottom of the pile.
So really a ruling, I mean, what could the future hold for the future of religious freedom? What do you think the future holds?
Well, if the cases aren't successful, I think it's particularly worrying, not just for Christians, but as I say, for other people as well who hold minority views, because if people are not going to be accommodated in their jobs, and we're not asking for outlandish concessions to be made, it's a matter of, for example, in the case of the civil registrar, a lady called Lillian Liddell, she said she didn't want to preside over civil partnerships, same-sex civil partnerships, but she was willing to take on more funerals, for example, if someone could cover her for the times when there were civil partnerships that needed to be presided over. So it's just common sense, really. And if the cases aren't successful, then the public space for Christians is just going to continue to shrink, and certain jobs will not be open to Christians, and therefore Christians won't be able to be involved in every aspect of society. Certain jobs, there'll be a religious bar to office, as it were, where certain jobs are not open to them.
That was Peter Norris of the group Christian Concern speaking to my colleague Lydia O'Kane. And we end this programme with another sound clip of the voice of Blessed Mother Teresa of Calcutta, who died 15 years ago on this date.
Lord, make me a channel of your peace, that where there is hatred, I may bring love. Where there is wrong, I may bring the spirit of forgiveness. Where there is doubt, I may bring faith. Where there is sadness, I may bring joy. For it is by forgetting self that one finds. It is by forgiving that one is forgiven. It is by dying that one awakens to eternal life.
That's all for today from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English programme. But we'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow. And you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.